The Diary of a CTO podcast. Sharing the secrets of successful CTOs. Brought to you by Trumor, the home of technology recruitment. Hosted by Guy Bevington.
Cool. Well, Alan, welcome.
You're
Cheers.
Welcome. Cheers.
Thanks for being here with us today. Yeah, let's get a wet the whistle, lubricate the vocal cords. So, Alan, you are the CTO of Leesman. And Leesman is a company that is building a platform that measures the experience of employees in the workplace. And I've been really excited for today because I think there's a lot of synergies between the missions of True North and the missions of Leesman. We're very much focused around how can we help people be happy at work? And it sounds like you guys are also focused around how do you build better places for people to work as well. So yeah, feels like there's a lot of alignment there, and really keen to pick your brains today, hear a little bit more about your role and how you're doing it, essentially. So before we delve into that, it would be lovely just to talk a little bit about you and your background, how you kind of got into technology and how you've got to the position you have as a CTO. So if you'd be so kind, give us a little bit of an overview of your background and how we are where we are today.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. So I come from a science background. My degree was chemistry, biology, and then I ended up as a chemical engineer for a little while and realised that probably wasn't it. Okay. So pivoted into marketing, which I enjoyed a lot. And then through marketing, I joined a software business, eventually did a big digital change program for them and suddenly ended up on the other side of the fence and ended up in tech. So the digital change team stayed with me.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I was doing tech. The software business then was very much on-prem. We were trying to get it into cloud and there's still a kind of push through that. Mm. We were fairly early adopters. It was painful. Did a lot of work at that time abroad. So I was in China, I was in Thailand. Latterly, I've been working in Turkey. So, and I guess we'll come on to that in terms of part of that was budget restraint and having to chase resource where we could.
Yeah.
Part of it was trying to globalize. Mm. So there's a combination of the two there. And then, ended up at Leesman trying to bring the technology up to scratch. The founders wanted an exit. So there was a need to make sure that technology was going to be fine through the due diligence. Mm-hmm. So that was my primary role.
Okay.
And then here we are. So the sale went through. So that's happened.
Oh, fantastic.
We're now part of an American organization, HQO.
Okay.
So that brings new, fresh challenges.
Absolutely. Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you for that. And I'm always really interested to hear about successful leaders and how they've got to the position they've got to. And it sounds like you've taken quite a well-rounded route into technology, given that you started in marketing first and then entered the technology side. What do you feel that's given you as a toolkit, I guess, and sort of unique approach to the role of a CTO, having started your life? Obviously, you've always had that analytical side if you were in science, but getting the marketing piece as well. What do you think that kind of brought to your arsenal of tricks?
I think it's been interesting to use, as you say, that toolkit. In technology and technologists, we can be quite an insular bunch. We kind of dig in, get the job done. A lot of it is process driven. A lot of it is there's the feature. When can you deliver it by? And actually, as you say, it's about getting your head up. And certainly, I think the CTO role is very much about getting your head up. Mm. Surround yourself with good people that can do the job.
Yeah.
Get your head up. Talk to the business. Try and get in early to understand what the direction is.
Yeah.
Try and get... one of the key priorities is getting alignment and agreement.
Sure.
If you haven't got that, you pivot all over the place.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah.
very much working with leadership. And I think because... I speak that language. I have domain knowledge of commerciality alongside the tech.
Yeah.
It can be an easier conversation.
Yes.
I wouldn't say it's always easy, but it can be an easier conversation.
Sure. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and I definitely see that as some of the one of the hallmarks of some of the best CTOs I work with are people that are able to sort of remove that dotted line potentially that exists between technology and the business, and truly alignment, I think is the best word you use there, in terms of really align technology with the business goals. Just to sort of delve down a little bit further into that, because I think a lot of people would be really interested to understand how do you go about that in terms of understanding the business priorities, how do you go about prioritizing those different objectives, and
So really, it's very much, partly it's drawing on those skills. Some of the skills that I think I use the most are patience, undervalued skill, just actually sitting and listening, making sure that I've understood, making sure that I've played back what I've heard. Things sound really basic, but actually it's incredible how many times you can come out of a room with a view, and then when you double back and say, so just so I'm clear, we're building this, people in the room will go, no, well, that isn't the takeout.
Yeah.
So actually listening, being patient, understanding, and then some of the real dig in around the objectives, make sure that you know where you're going. Transparency, clarity, all those things that you can't always get. It'd be nice if they were there from the beginning. One of the things I'm really big on is bringing engineering as close to product as you can.
Yeah.
Some organizations like clear separation. Mm-hmm. They like the idea of C-suite, bunch of people driving out those objectives, bunch of people turning those into requirement, and then briefing engineering. That's a very linear journey, and it works. Mm-hmm. There is something about the art of the possible. And if you get somebody in the room early that says, I hear what you're trying to do, and actually, if you try it this way, this would be a better approach. Mm. So the earlier that art of the possible conversation can happen, the better. Mm. But it can be the case where, a bit like an architect, if you went to an architect and said, actually, what I want is a ceiling, but no walls, they would go away and contemplate that as an exercise and eventually come back and go, no, you're going to need a couple of walls.
Yeah.
So it's bringing that conversation forward.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you there. And we've definitely seen some really special things from companies that have been able to effectively amalgamate the product and engineering functions almost as one kind of seamless entity, because very often it isn't that case. And I think it goes back to your point of good common sense psychology of just having clarity and making sure that the message is being understood by everybody at the same time, and not one team's not going off down that avenue and the other team's not going off down that avenue. So it's certainly something I see as a big part, especially as we're becoming more productized. All businesses, really, to all intents and purposes, are going to be product-led businesses, I suppose, moving forward. So I think it's even more important now than ever before.
I think that product-led statement is becoming the key, as you say. Mm. Cloud, new technologies, you look at AI at the moment, quite often ideas have been sitting there waiting for technology to enable it. It may not be a new idea. It may have been something that a business has been trying to do for a while.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the technology lands and you go, we can do that now. That's enabling us to go there.
Yeah.
But it's always got to fit to what direction is it? Or if it's a pivot, and one of the things I would say about CTOs is you need a bit of bravery sometimes because you're asked to make decisions that stand up in 2 or 3 years' time that... Mm. The business may have pivoted 5 times in those 2 or 3 years, but actually you've made some architectural decisions that still need to be of value.
Mm. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I suppose with that in mind, from a sort of technological landscape of, the role of a CTO obviously is very subjective. It means lots of different things at different companies depending on the size of the business and the maturity of the business, but ultimately, should encompass all things technical, moving forward. And I suppose where we are in the world today, you mentioned AI, just in the last 2-3 years, the world has dramatically changed and had a seismic shift, evolution in technology there. What other areas of technology do you think should be particularly pressing for CTOs now, and what's kind of on your radar, I suppose, as most important things to consider as a CTO?
I think there's some balance between new. So innovation for me is very much, you can have innovation across a business and you should have innovation across a business. There's a there's a kind of chief innovation officer type role, and there can be confusion around that, which is the business sometimes thinks, well, you're in charge of innovation. That's not the role for me. You might have somebody enabling delivery and harnessing ideas and making sure that they align with the business priority and saying, this is a good one, and I'm going to execute on that. I'm going to get a team that can deliver that. So there is something about innovation that's here. Even down to, we're looking at a voice, for instance, and voice has been around for ages. Hmm. But actually what we're thinking is, wouldn't it be better if someone could sit in a room and talk to our system and say, what's my highest performing building in Singapore? They don't want to have to delve to find the information.
Yeah.
Just use voice and we'll deliver that back. Just, you know, removing friction from somebody's daily work is quite key.
Yes.
But over the horizon, yeah, AI, I mean, I suppose I look at AI as something that allows humans to do higher value work at the moment.
Yeah,
I think AI, if it had a voice, would think, no, I'm way more than that. I saw a product the other day where they're using AI to digitally code, and they'd pointed it at Upwork. So that website where people post jobs.
Yeah.
So they pointed it at Upwork and said, go and pull a job down, a coding job, do that job, deliver the result and get paid. Now that's the ultimate side hustle.
Absolutely.
I'll sit on the beach, thank you, and my AI dev can do its thing. Yeah. That's not going to happen in reality. I don't see many corporate banks opening up their ports for a remote AI dev to come in and do the job.
Yeah.
So there's something about AI. I was thinking about this on the train coming in. You know, what is it that there's the well? I'm sure we'll loop back on DigiSec, and there's a whole thing around DigiSec and how it might influence business. Next gen computing, but it keeps being talked about. So you've got quantum. You've got, was it Apple's PQ3? That sort of, you know, there's something about blockchain and Web3, and it actually just being finally able to deliver a safer web using blockchain and token, and can't ignore Decent and the whole finance, but there's a geopolitical element to that. These are the types of things that are coming. Now, whether they're of value in an average CTO's day-to-day job, who knows? I suppose finally bringing it closer to home, connectivity of things. Although I heard a wonderful story yesterday, and I did Google it for veracity, where a casino got hacked through the thermometer in their fish tank.
Wow.
Which is fantastic. I mean, I'm almost applauding the hackers.
Yeah, fair play. Yeah, give them that one. That's Ocean's 11 type stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. Through the fish tank thermometer.
How did they do that?
It literally, because the fish tank thermometer was connected.
Okay.
So someone had gone, oh, that's cool.
So Wi-Fi.
I can see what the temperature is in the fish tank.
Right.
In they go, into the high roller database, pulled all the data back through the thermometer, and away they go.
Wow.
Clever stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think it's a really good point. Like I say, I think anybody's guess at the moment as to how the CTO role is going to evolve. But like I say, in the day-to-day operations of a CTO, should they be bothered about things like DigiSec? But I think the fact we're evolving at the speed we are evolving, and AI is obviously exponentially becoming more and more used, I do think that the DigiSec conversation enters the scene a lot more readily and should enter the scene a lot more readily, because ultimately I think it's going to become a lot more prevalent to be able to control that power and, like you say, sort of mitigate the risk of what it potentially may pose. So how do you see that sort of DigiSec landscape evolving as we go sort of side by side alongside the advancements in AI?
So this is, we've spoken previously offline, this is a bit of a thing for me where I don't know how CTOs ended up with DigiSec and compliance. I just think they just didn't duck fast enough in the room. But it does tend to sit with a CTO. Maybe it's a legacy back to old CTO when infrastructure was part of the remit if you hadn't gone cloud. What I've experienced over the last 3 or 4 years is DigiSec gets in the way of onboarding clients. It becomes a hurdle.
Okay.
And that's how it's seen in the business. So reputationally, it's an interesting one, because if DigiSec is seen as a blocker to onboarding business, who owns DigiSec? The technology team do. Ergo, the technology team are blocking us doing business. Mm. So there's something about actually reputationally managing that as a CTO, because I've heard conversations, not been in the room, but heard conversations where we are blamed for business not happening, and that's unfortunate and wrong. So there is a blocker around DigiSec. Equally, there's the way, I think when DigiSec became a thing of itself and became a sector, and I was at a conference yesterday and it was standing room only about cybersecurity. So there's a lot of people making good money around it. Then they have a vested interest in keeping it, keeping the whole industry going.
Yes.
So in short, my take on DigiSec is move to a risk-based, more to a risk-based approach than a policy framework approach.
Okay.
Currently, it's policy and framework. It's here's our 300 question DigiSec. Can you complete it by next Wednesday? And then when you've done that, look, that's opened up another 60 questions.
Not the sexiest of ways of engaging.
And it isn't. It's not driven by the risk. So, you know, we work with a lot of global corporate banks, and I'm very proud of getting through every single DigiSec we've had with them.
Right.
Some of them were really tough. And then we were working with one of the biggest banks in the world, and they were using one of the big five consultancies to run their DigiSec. And I paused it and said, we need a conversation. You need to understand the data that we're collecting, the nature of it, how low risk it is.
Yeah.
You're doing a big global corporate bank, DigiSec, on a company that's asking people about what they think about their chair at the end of the day, or this space, or whatever it is. So can we match the DigiSec to the risk of the data? And that, I think you'll get better outcomes, and the business will understand and try and comply with DigiSec better. If you, as I say, move away from policy and frame. Design DigiSec around policy and framework, but then do it on a risk basis.
Okay.
Would be my plea. We had a DigiSec that ran for a year. The client came to us, you know, nominally in January, and we onboarded them in December. That they clearly wanted to work with us, because that's nuts.
Yeah,
that's 12 months.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, so you think about those stories, and you sort of see the fingers of blame being pointed of DigiSec being the reason, yeah, things can't progress. But I guess in the same breath, it's a case of a bit like insurance, really. You don't know you need it until you need it.
Exactly.
And obviously, like I said, there's this huge ramifications of not having that in place. But I suppose there's a real education piece within the business to, you know, take people on that journey of, you know, winning hearts and minds to get them to understand if we didn't have this, the proverbial could hit the fan pretty quickly. And, you know,
absolutely,
that's going to be far more detrimental to the business relationship than, you know, bringing them on board in the first place. So how do you approach those conversations as a CTO, like you say, when there is potentially that tendency to just sort of point the finger of blame and go, well, this is just a, you know, a necessary evil that needs to happen? How do you sort of engage the business into that?
I think one of the things we did, it's interesting you talk about cyber insurance, actually, because everybody needs cyber insurance. You can't operate now. You know, it's one of the DigiSec questions.
Yeah.
So you could look at cyber insurance and go, like a lot of insurances, oh, it's there if we need it. Actually, one of the policies that we took out came with its own training portal. And it was, and I'm not going to name the company, it was dreadful. So we'd done a big thing around, good news, we've got this training portal, everyone can log in, you can, you know, educate yourself around spear attacks, spear phishing, whatever it is. Nightmare, because everyone in the business looked at it as another piece of work.
Yeah.
They literally said, I haven't had time to do that. And then suddenly the system started sending auto emails out to say, you're overdue. Nobody wants that. No, and it positions it badly.
Yeah.
So actually, something about nudging people and having an AI can do a lot of this. If you start to nudge people along the journey of digital security, and I'm talking in-house here rather than, you know, external attacks in terms of data, but actually internal training or just nudging people to say, you've put a USB in the machine. Are you sure you want to do that? Mm. You know, is it? Yeah, you know, that's against policy. Is there another way you can get this data that you're trying to get?
Yes.
So it's nudging people along it.
Yeah.
Externally, from a bad actor point of view, you're into security by design. You know, if you're trying to instill that in the development team that you have to say, alongside everything else you're trying to do to get this feature out the door, could you just have one eye on security as well? Mm. So if you do it at source, you're in a much more robust position.
Yes, yes. Interestingly, you mentioned that. It kind of feels like, in a way, there's a space there for where AI and that sort of frictionless approach could enter into the way you engage with,
very much so,
with digital security. So yeah, that's an interesting point of view, actually. You mentioned, you know, they're talking about your engineers and earlier talking about, you know, hiring smart people. As a CTO, how do you go about assessing talent to join the business? Are there particular characteristics, traits that you hire against? I appreciate every role will have different technical nuances, but how do you sort of look at that approach to growing a team, you know, between the skills and sort of attitude and aptitude conversation?
Really good question. I mean, there's the talent game, and you're in it, is a really tough arena for technology and technologists, not least of which what they cost. And I'm not saying they're not worth it, let's be very clear. But it is difficult to recruit and retain good people. So, you know, that's why I've ended up in China and Thailand and latterly Turkey, because, you know, it's a value decision. I always used to, it really used to wind me up when RFD would say, oh, it's great, you know, it's cheap developers. They're not cheap, it's value.
Yeah.
And there is a difference. We're not just buying the cheapest person because it ticks the box on the org chart. Yeah. They still have to deliver.
Yeah.
So it is a value-based decision. But actually, to answer your question, probably depends on the size of the team. So smaller teams, I'm looking for all-rounders. They need to own end-to-end delivery, literally from writing the test to pushing the code. There's no DevOps. There's no fat in the budget to have DevOps within a small team. So you need a good all-rounder.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger teams, you still need all-rounders, but actually you could get some domain expertise in there. But what I tend to do is buy it in when I need it.
Okay.
So we didn't have much serverless knowledge, if any, in-house, and then we decided on serverless as an architecture. So you go out and find somebody that has their expertise.
Mm.
Number one on their brief of a list of objectives is knowledge transfer. You don't leave this job until you've transferred the knowledge into the team. So and you buy it that way.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And then there's something about, if you're looking at the individuals themselves, I think you ignore diversity at your peril, because, and diversity across the piece.
Yeah.
Because I think you just ship better product if you have diversity.
Yeah.
Because within your team, you have a bunch of people that see stuff that I don't see.
Yeah.
So there's something about, you know, race, gender, neurodiversity. Neurodiversity is fascinating to me.
Mm.
There was a guy on BBC News, I think it was last week, talking about, he runs an autism charity.
Okay.
And he's basically saying, don't ignore autistic people. Right. If you have a job that is high intensity, high concentration, repetitive, these are your people.
Absolutely.
These are the people they will do that job all day long.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, again, that perspective. But you actually, as a leader, if you're building a diverse team, you then have to have that understanding that they operate differently.
Mm.
So I was chatting to somebody yesterday who said, autistic, ADHD, staggering levels of concentration, no concept of time. Absolutely. She basically said, you know, I'll talk about, the other day, and I might be talking about 1984. So there's an understanding that, you know, that you have to speak their language.
Yeah.
So actually, I think that's part of a CTO's remit. You have to understand the language.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. One of the most gifted data professionals I've ever worked with. Actually, I'd classify him now as a really strong friend. In fact, I recorded a podcast with him a few weeks ago, is, you know, and his admission, you know, very much autistic to the degree he was, I think, non-verbal until the age of 16.
Yeah.
You know, to meet him now, you literally would have no clue. He kind of advanced very, very quickly on that front, but unbelievably gifted, intelligent individual. Just, you know, one of the most kind of cultured and read people I've ever come across. But one of the things I love about him is he's very open with acknowledging the fact there's certain things he doesn't do the same as other people, and helping you understand, you know, what those are and how you can best work with them to, you know, it be a fruitful interaction or whatever. And yeah, I totally agree with you. And he kind of really opened my eyes to the whole neurodiverse field of, you know, it's in many ways, you know, it's a superpower.
Yeah, it is.
And a lot of people, you know, maybe not perceive it like that, but you know, like I say, to their peril at the end of the day, because they'd be missing out on what is really an exceptional
there's a whole pool of talent out there.
Yeah.
And actually, I think one of the rise of techies has been it's given voice to neurodivergent people, because, you know, quite often they were still doing their job.
Yeah.
And people were kind of thinking, that person's a bit tricky, and, you know, I can never seem to get the conversation right, or they always seem to be annoyed with me, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But actually, the rise of technology and techies, that conversation has opened up, thankfully, you know. So there's a platform and a voice.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Just going back to one of the points you mentioned earlier about the team size and the different skills that you need. I totally agree with you there, and understand that, you know, for a smaller team, you would need somebody to be able to wear many hats, rather than a bigger team, we have the luxury of people potentially specialising a little bit more. Where do you sit on the question of junior talent, sort of fostering junior talent and bringing them up through the ranks, training them? Especially given we're talking about the advancement in AI now. In fact, we did a CTO roundtable a couple of weeks back, where one of the questions from the CTO that attended was, you know, is AI making junior developers worse developers? You know, because there's this whole conversation between do we still hire junior developers in and grow them up, or actually are we saving £30,000 hiring a junior dev, and actually just a lot of the work they would be doing we can now give to ChatGPT, so on and so forth. And there was this real kind of to and fro in the room between, you know, how AI, LLMs, etc. is sort of reshaping the world at that level, that sort of junior development level. What are your thoughts on that in terms of how you approach things as a CTO?
I think I know for a fact my team use ChatGPT. I know they do. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But it's a bit like going to the library. Yeah, I need to gen up on something, I'll do that. My advice to them is always the same. Ask the question three times. If you get the same answer back three times, largely it might be correct. So it's something about using it again as a tool, as part of as part of the toolbox. We have had the discussion, and we continue to, around how do we build it in, and are there processes that, particularly junior devs, when they're starting out, that they tend to get the lower level work, just seems to be the nature of it. You're not going to let them loose on your sensitive data from day one. So it's, can they leverage those tools? And actually, can they add value by saying, do you know what? I've built this model that will do this thing for me now. Can we test it? Can we run it? So actually, from a junior dev's point of view, it can be really hard when you join a company to show value. You really want to get quick wins.
Yeah.
And we always check when we onboard devs, how was it for them?
Mm.
And one of the big pieces of feedback we get is, I'd really like to push some code in the first week. I'd like to feel like I've done something. Whereas we thought we were protecting them by saying, no, it's fine. You take your time to learn.
Yeah.
You take it. Not a bit.
Interesting.
They want to get in. They want to get hands on keyboards and ideally push a bit of code in the first week.
Okay.
So, yeah. Again, there's that, right, can you leverage AI to do that? Or, you know, they're coming usually fresh out of first job or uni. They've got eyes on stuff that I haven't seen for a long time.
Mm.
You know, they may well have started their course doing something, and by the end of it, it's changed.
Yeah.
Because the pace has changed. So bringing ideas, great. And then actually it's the role of myself and head of engineering to give them a safe space so they can fail.
Yes.
And that can be quite hard because business still, I think, almost sees technology as infallible. It still seems to shock to them when something doesn't work.
That was a testament to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We were chatting the other day and our deputy CEO said an interesting thing, which is it must be quite frustrating working in technology because it's rare that someone comes along and says, that's great. They'll come along and say, that didn't work. Mm. But, a good day is when no one's told you something's not working. Yeah. It's that sort of approach.
Absolutely.
But, bringing junior devs on and then actually trying to hold on to them. We made a mistake when we went to China in hindsight, where our offices was opposite Microsoft.
Okay.
So I'd got a relationship with a university. I'm pulling grads out of uni. I could watch them walk over the road within a year. So I was a training ground for Microsoft devs. Mm.
You're also training them well.
Well, I mean,
jobs at Microsoft.
If they were getting jobs, absolutely. Yeah. But it did become frustrating because you sort of think, wow, I've invested a year in you and off you go over the road, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know, it's especially at that junior level, like you say, you're probably taking somebody from, not zero, but you know what I mean, like zero to one, and then obviously losing them at that stage. Yeah, I can imagine that is quite frustrating.
The other thing about AI, just looping back to your question, though, is it can get junior devs up and running faster.
Yeah.
So, quite often they come in and they get testing or they get QA or they, whatever it is that the other devs don't want to do. Mm. Actually, AI can get them up and running faster and help them problem solve faster.
Yeah, 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 absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And I like the fact that you were talking about you're trying to get their feedback of what they're experiencing. As much as we can sit here and guess what they want to be doing and how they want to be getting up and running, it's nice to actually capture that feedback. And I suppose Leesman probably as a business is very uniquely qualified to capture that data and obviously understand genuinely how people are feeling.
We're a listening business. Yeah. Well, we're listening on behalf of our clients, but we're a listening business. There is something about, we're trying to help clients hear that voice and then make some change around it.
Mm.
Or do more of the same if they're doing well.
It's working. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about where things haven't always gone to plan, because I think there's probably as much learning and value in hearing about the catastrophes as it was about hearing about the success stories. But talk me through, it could be in either the context of Leesman or elsewhere, but probably one of the biggest challenges you face as a CTO and how you've been able to overcome that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a couple. You can't not get to my age and not have a few catastrophes. I'm not going to name the company, but we did have an issue where some secrets got posted on the public code base, and suddenly someone had run up the maximum servers in the maximum regions in AWS and started mining Bitcoin.
I've heard of a few horror stories on there
and
spinning up.
And actually, what it is it's a classic tale of was our DR policy right? And, was our business continuity policy right? And the answer was no on both counts. So, because you're locked out of your own environment. That's number one. So your first signal is you're locked out your own environment. The process of getting unlocked is really difficult. It probably should be, but it's really difficult. All the time in the background, this thing, the clock is running. Whoever it is, the bad actor is, doing what they're doing. So we got lucky in that they did it on a Friday morning. My view is if they'd done it on a Friday evening, I don't think our policies were robust enough to know until Monday when we got back in.
Right.
That would have been 48 hours of expenditure, essentially. And AWS...
Shudder to think of that, don't you?
Well, and AWS are not very considerate when you say oops.
Yeah, it's the reason Mr. Bezos is...
He's flying to the moon.
The richest man in the
world. Yeah. So, I mean, there were lots of lessons learned there. Mainly around having been the man sitting here having a pop-up policy, maybe around policy and just how did we fall over there? There's something about how it happened and... how was that? How could you do that? How was a developer able to post secrets, you know, into GitHub. That's number one, because you've got to have safeguards against that.
Yeah.
But then, you know, a so-called never event happens. So then it's about how do you learn, and equally, something about how you then react to that. And I had a boss years ago who, in an appraisal, said to me, she said, "I've got some difficult feedback for you." And I went, "Go on then." She said, "You never seem bothered about anything." And I said, "How's that?" And she said, "Well, we had a problem the other day, and I was explaining it." And I said, "Just because I don't run around waving my arms above my head, shouting fire, it doesn't mean I'm not bothered." But actually, quite often in technology, you have to come at things fairly coldly to make sensible decisions. So, you know,
well, I think leadership in general, to be honest,
it's very much, you know, just stay calm, you know, work the problem.
I was ingratiated into the concept of the Swan effect a while ago, which has always stuck with me about leadership, that, you know, you can be going 10 to the dozen under the water and panicking, and obviously, but you have to come across as calm and control, because ultimately who's going to benefit if you don't do that, you know?
All that will happen is you'll panic people around you, because then they'll start thinking, oh, blimey, this really is serious.
If this person's panicked, he's supposed to know what they're doing. And
exactly
that, yeah.
So you just, you know, you just, so that, I think that was a particularly bad one. We got caught in a data breach that wasn't ours, but we got caught in the crossfire, and that was frustrating.
Right.
So we used a marketing mailing company, and they had a breach.
Right.
And one of our mailing campaigns was hijacked and then used to send, attempted to send a virus through a PDF to our client base.
Oh, right.
And we lost some business on that, which was frustrating. And no amount of... We followed process and, you know, went through the procedure and traced it through... But that the confidence from that client had gone down at that point.
Yeah.
And it actually talking to their technology team and their CTO, he got it straight away. He said, "Alan, there's not a lot I can do here. I can't bring the business round. You know, it happened. Somebody clicked it our end, and, you know, here we are."
Mm.
So the reputational damage from that is huge.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's so difficult as well, isn't it? Because, like you say, especially when it's a third party, you know, but I suppose that...
And there was no ownership at the third party. Hey, obviously, we're not using them again. But there was no ownership there, and no real procedure around how they were dealing with it.
Mm.
I found myself having to drive them all of the time to say, "You need to do this next. And have you notified ICO? And have you done this?"
Yeah.
So that was frustrating.
It's very interesting, isn't it, from a brand propositioning point of view and like I say, reputational damage, because it's a huge spectrum, I suppose. I'm always really interested to hear these stories about how companies, unfortunately, get into these situations, how their clients react to that, and a huge spectrum of people that actually are hugely empathetic, you know, at one end, and realise that it's not a lot we could have done here, really, but the other end of the coin is those people who, you know, obviously become irate. And protect
themselves, quite naturally.
Yeah.
You know, I saw a stat yesterday, which was quite startling, and I am going to check the veracity of it, but the stat was 80% of companies that have had a cyber attack are dead in 2 years. That is a startling statistic, if true. And also what surprised me was, because you only ever really hear of the big global organizations that get an attack. The majority of them are in small SMEs, and they're not geared up to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of smacks of the adage of it takes years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to burn it,
completely,
doesn't it?
And I suppose
it's very true. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Well, Alan, really, really interesting conversation with you today. Can see, you know, why Leesman is so successful having you at the helm with your approach.
That's kind.
But I always like to end every podcast with asking the same question, if you'd care to indulge me, which is, what's your favourite piece of advice you've either received or given throughout your career that you would care to pass on to your fellow humankind? What would you say that would be?
So I did give this a good dose of thinking about, and I've had many people tell me things or call me things, But actually, the best I can't remember whether I read it or somebody said it to me, which was, you never win an argument, you succeed in silencing the other person. And I liked that kind of view of, you know. I'll end on that one.
Yeah, I like that a lot. It's so true, isn't it? Like, we often sit there and just you know, fight our corner knowing that we're right. But, you know, it's a bit like, somebody said to me the other day, a similar thing, that in any war, nobody thinks they're in the wrong.
Yeah.
And it's so true. It's the same thing whenever you're kind of arguing against somebody, even though you can feel so adamantly you're right. You know, you've always got to respect the fact that they also feel they're right.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you've got to, yeah, great. I like that. Good way to end. Well, look, thank you very much for coming on. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you very much.
And wish you all the very best of success with Leesman moving forward. I'm sure you'll go from strength to strength. And please do come back and have another chat with us at some point in future. Love to see how you're getting on.
Brilliant. Thanks, Guy.